session number 27073, rule 4.
Billy Drake, rule 4.
Right, so next day, which was, I think, the 12th, was it? The 12th. I went off with Prosser Hanks on a patrol, and when we got close to Holland and Maastricht Bridge, we saw a real big pile-up of German aeroplanes there, and witnessed the actual bombing of the Maastricht Bridge by the battles of the Royal Air Force, where the leader got his Victoria Cross. And I was very pleased with Prosser's attitude towards this. And he saw all these 109s, and he said, this is not for us. And we went home, because had we got involved, about 200 109s and just the four of us, would have been an absolute massacre. And his attitude was to... Anyway, got home, got refueled, and went up again. And the airplane, my particular airplane, had been unserviceable, so I got into another one and joined Prosser on a patrol, four of us, and at 18,000 feet I realized that my oxygen wasn't, in fact, it must have been empty because there was no indication that I had any oxygen at all. So I called him up and said, I have no oxygen and I'm feeling a bit woozy. Permission to break away and go home, which he said, yes, carry on. And on my way back, I saw at about 15,000 feet some Dorniers, I think four Dorniers, and got behind one, shot it down, and was in the process of shooting another one or getting into position to shoot, when I heard one almighty thump, and I burst into flames, found that I was covered in petrol and glycol and everything, and realized that I wasn't doing much good sticking around, so I better bail out. And I happened to look behind, and there was a Messerschmitt 110 behind me, and he'd been a bloody good shot because I had some shrapnel in my legs and my back, etc., etc., and decided to bail out because I was in flames. But because the hood was shut, the flames didn't come into the cockpit. But panic had by this time set in, and I undid everything, but failed to open the hood. And when I tried to get out, I couldn't because the hood was in the way. By the time I realized what had happened, I was upside down, which probably saved my life because all the flames went up and missed the cockpit. And I was able then to release the hood and to drop out of the airplane. I think, but I might be completely wrong, that the 110 was shooting at me, but I might have been completely wrong. So I landed in a field, and my next sight was not all that good. It was a whole bunch of Frenchmen with scythes and pitchforks coming at me with very, very nasty thoughts going through their mind. And but in my very best French, I was able to persuade them that I was a pilote anglais, And they said, oh, mon Dieu, always had effect, and embraced me with all that thing. And then apparently one of them said that he knew where the hospital was and he'd take me there. And on the way took me to a French medical clearing station, because my back was hurting quite a bit, and I thought, you know, that I was seriously wounded. And so I arrived at this French clearing station to be told by the French airman, or French medical person, that there was no doctor, that he'd see what he could do to relieve me of what was hurting my back, but unfortunately had no anaesthetic. So I said, well, carry on, or worse that effect. So he dug all this stuff out of me, which made me cloth and everything. And by the time he'd done it, but the one abiding memory was he stank of garlic, and I've never been able to eat anything that was tainted with garlic since. And so the chap who'd taken me there with his car took me on to the hospital at Rethel, where I stayed for another 24 hours, and by which time Paul had been told of my presence there and came along and took a list of all the things that I'd like to have had, but never did get it, because we were evacuated next day to go to a place called Chartres, which is south of Paris, by train. And when I arrived at this beautiful chateau, which had been turned into a hospital, I was in the garden there and I saw a chap with his helmet on. I thought, oh, extraordinary chap. And until I got closer to him, and I realised that he couldn't do anything about his helmet, because most of it had been knocked into his head. I said, what are you doing? So he explained that there was nothing much that he could do, that he was still waiting for a brain surgeon to appear on the scene to remove this ad. And that's the last time I saw him. And then I'd got a message through to my girlfriend, who was in running a part of the an ambulance call. And so she arrived in car and in uniform, and was taking me back to Paris. When we were stopped by the French police, I had been relieved of my uniform and was in a sort of a mixture of civilian clothes. And they sort of looked at her and said, well, and what is that? And they were firmly of the opinion that I was a fifth columnist and had the shooting squadron all ready to put me up against the wall. And she was panicking a bit by this. But luckily, before she did anything sensible, we rang up the British embassy to find that they'd all buggered off to Bordeaux or somewhere. So we had nobody to verify as to who I was, except luckily she was friendly with the American embassy, because she was half American, and was able to get on to one of their diplomats. And they were able to explain to the gendarmerie that I was a true and brave English officer, not to shoot me. And that was that. So got back to her place, stayed there for a couple of days, but had to leave because the Germans were walking into Paris. And so she and her mother lent me one of their cars full of petrol, and I was able to motor down to Le Mans where the squadron was. And so that was my escape from there. I was flown out of Le Mans to Jersey, back to Tangmere.
Who did you fly out with?
Ferry pilot, who luckily was going the same direction as myself.
Had the squadron taken any casualties, obviously, during that period?
Oh, yes, they'd lost about four Clisby, Lorimer, Pussy Bomb being shot down but not killed, and one or two others.
Because I believe as well that there's an adaptation that was made to the Hurricanes during that period of fighting, in the sense of an armoured seat.
Oh, yeah, well, we had no armour plating. It hadn't been a part of the design structure. And the question of putting it in was looked at by the hurricane, by the designer of the airplane, to see whether a chunk of armour plating could be installed behind the pilot without affecting the centre of gravity. By the time they decided that the centre of gravity wouldn't be badly, we got our armour plating just in time. And that virtually saved my life, because I've since found that the armour plating that was protecting me in this particular airplane had a big hole right where my head was. Not a hole, but a dent where a bullet had hit it. And if I hadn't had any armour plating, it would have gone straight into my nut.
I was going to ask you, because I believe they just found your Hurricane, the remains of your Hurricane in France, haven't they?
Yeah, that was a film being made by the BBC on there, and I've actually seen the armour plating at the factory that rebuilds Spitfires in the Isle of Wight.
And would it have been a bullet, or would you think it may have been a cannon shot?
Impossible to say. I think it must have been cannons and bullets.
Because your wounds, what had caused the wounds in your leg, was that?
That was shrapnel. Bits and pieces kept falling out of my leg for the next year or so. Every time I went for a bath, there was a tinkle. But this had all been taken out. But, my God, that was quite close in there anyway.
Did the wounds heal okay?
Yeah. Luckily, what happened was that I had my uniform, my flying kit, and an overcoat I'd keep, because the Hurricane was a very cold airplane, and so whatever one could wear to keep one warm did, and luckily that was all impacted instead of cold steel.
You say an overcoat, was it a flying jacket? Or?
No, it was just an old wash me boy overcoat.
And would you wear flying boots at that period?
I had flying boots, yeah.
So you've just returned to the UK. What was your next posting?
Yes, I was still not 100% fit, so I was posted up to Sutton Bridge to an operational training unit, training pilots to fly Hurricanes. This is just before the Battle of Britain. Most of the pilots were RAF, apart from a large contingent of Polish pilots who had fought in Poland and in France. So they're quite experienced people. And I had one very funny experience of a funny corporal pilot, Tubby, practically no hair at all. And I said, OK, we'll go up and we'll do one or two little tours. And so I went up there, and the next thing I looked around, there was no hurricane at all. I thought, it was a silly little bugger. I wonder where he is. And he was right behind there. So I did everything I could think of, and I knew, really knew how to. And he was there, sort of smoking a cigarette practically. And so when I landed, I spoke to one of his companions, who was a very senior captain or flight lieutenant. I said, who the hell was that? And I said, he said, oh, that is Urbanovich or something like that. He was the Polish aerobatic ace for the last 25 years. And no wonder you couldn't get rid of him. Yeah. So I was there at Sutton Bridge, as I said, teaching people. And
can I ask you what advice you were able to impart? Because obviously you had combat experience. Many of the instructors, many of the instructors within the UK wouldn't have had combat experience.
In operational training, yeah. Training units, they all had operational.
Right.
They weren't flying training units. These were a part of fighter command, where all pilots who came from the flying thing or were being posted came through us to be taught the rudiments of what we had to say about the airplane that they were probably going to be operational on.
And were you able to give them advice about what you from your experiences?
Whatever experience we had, yeah.
Obviously, during that period, though, the Battle of Britain was going on.
That was brewing up, and the chief flying instructor there was a man who eventually became an air marshal by the name of Edwards Jones. And we got on quite well, and I kept on knocking on his door, saying, please, sir, can I go south? Said, no, you can't. Anyway, he rang me up one day, said, come to the office, I want to speak to you. I said, Christ, what have I done now? And he said, Billy, I'm getting rid of you. I've had enough of you. And I've got you a job as a flight commander in my old squadron, 213 Squadron at Tangmere. So I said, ta-ta, and motor on down there, joined 112 Squadron, did about a week's flying with them, that's a bit of Battle of Britain. And then the CEO of that squadron, again, a friend of mine, said, Billy, normally I don't want to get rid of anybody, but I think this is something up your sleeve. We do want volunteers. There's a unit that's been formed down at Westmorling called 421 Flight, called Jim Crow's. Would you like to join them? I said, well, if the way you put it, yes. So he said, well, I think it would be a good move for you, but I'd hate to lose you. And it had been commanded anyway by a friend of mine, Paddy Green, who was a 601 Squadron pilot, and joined them, and found out that their job, actually I found out before I left Tangmere, but I was fully briefed by the time I got down there, their job was that because a lot of the forward radar station had been knocked out by the German Air Force, they weren't getting all the information they required to carry on the task of 11 Group. And so we were formed, and they were getting enough information on the approximate size of the formation that was, where they were coming from, what height they were, and what direction they were going. And we were we were advised that our job was to go out, intercept these formations, come back with as much information, or whilst in the air, as much information that we could divulge, and security wasn't involved, straight onto the plotting board of 11 Group. And it was from our information and the information they were already getting from what was remaining of the radar sites that they're able to carry out the job of intercepting the German Air Force.
That sounds quite a dangerous position to be in, shadowing
it was, German forces. But it's interesting, what they thought we would do first was to go at height and look down. We said no, we'd much rather be low down and look up, and we can see everybody, including people that are trying to shoot us down, because it was highly dangerous, because not only were the Germans having a look at us, but also our own people. All they saw was an aeroplane. They didn't have much chance of recognition to say what type of aeroplane. So, as you say, as a result of that, our language is a bit fruity. And Keith Parks rang me up. He said, "Billy, I'd like you to come and have lunch." I said, "Well, I wonder what's happening now." So I went along, had lunch, and he said, "Right, now, Billy, I'd like you to come down to the ops room." I hadn't said anything. I went down there, and it's quite quiet until suddenly the most bloody awful language coming straight up. I couldn't make it out. And all these little girls blushing. Oops, oops. And we walked out and said, "Have you got the message, Billy? Would you kindly inform the pilots to be a little more moderate in their language?"
Yeah. That kind of language, was that coming from the position that he was at nervousness?
We were talking direct. We didn't know the information was coming direct onto the plotting board.
So you just thought it was being filtered?
That's right, yeah.
I see. You mentioned the dangers there of being misidentified. Were you ever attacked at any stage by any of our own aircraft?
Oh, yes. Attacked, but luckily their recognition ability was sufficient that when they got fairly close they could see that we were. But it is of interest. We started off by being equipped with Hurricanes, and we rang up Keith Parr and said, "Look, this aeroplane is no bloody good. It's not fast enough for the... we would like some Spitfire 2s, which is the very latest, because we need the speed." He said, "Sure." And within a week, we were completely re-equipped with Spitfire 2s.
Was it the usual method of converting to Spitfires?
Yes. No problem at all.
The same as what had happened with the Hurricane?
Sure. Yeah.
What did you think of the Spitfire? Because that was the first
time. Well, I liked it, and particularly as it was a very hairy job that we were doing. And we wanted something as fast as possible and as manoeuvrable as possible.
How would it hold up against the German fighter opposition, the Spitfire?
Well, we didn't have very much at that particular period. The Germans or us only had a fleeting look at us and then pissed off and rejoined their units and left us fairly alone.
Was there any occasions where you attacked German aircraft during these duties?
No, we were far too busy doing our primary job, and we were told your primary job is...
So with that primary job, it would be reporting back what, numbers or heights or that
numbers,
sort of thing?
Heights and directions and the type of formations. And that went straight onto the board, and you've seen the board, they have numbers and the types, and it's, so the the discs were being changed according to our information.
How did you estimate numbers?
We just had a bloody good look. Plus or minus 50. I mean, we'd say 200 plus or 300 plus bombers with... I can see some 109s and even higher. I can see other contrails, probably fighter escorts.
Were the Germans sending over in large numbers still in October, or was there a change?
Well, this is right in the middle of the Battle of Britain. So formations of 300, 400.
At that point, you said that you'd been asked to do the job by Keith Park. What did you think of him as a commander?
Well, we had a lot of time for him, particularly those who had served with him before the war, Tang, as their station commander. He's a pedantic old chap, he was a pedantic man. But we had a lot of respect because he wanted to fly with us. He did fly with us, not operationally, but he showed willing.
And did you feel that during that period he was his tactics worked well?
Oh, yes. We were certain that he told us. He said, my job at the moment is to get as many into the air as I possibly can without jeopardizing our time factor of our thing, and therefore anything more than 24 airplanes was usually non-viable.
And when you were working in the flight, would it be just on the Jim Crow operations, would it just be yourself in a single
No, two of us. As a leader and a number two to look after me.
And that would be the standard procedure, would it, for the whole of the flight?
By this time, we were beginning to throw away the Vic formation, the threes, with Arsene Charlie doing, and therefore it was always two lots of pairs making the... And you just multiply that by X.
Is that what the Germans call the finger four?
That is the finger four. So everybody is looking at everybody's tail, including the leader.
And there was a marked improvement for you?
Oh, yes, because everybody had a job. If I was there, I had the whole of these three to look after. And these had these three to look after, including the leader.